The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here today with IJ Senior Attorney Bob McNamara and IJ Attorney Patrick Giacomo. This term, the U.S. Supreme Court considered a slew of petitions dealing with the doctrine of qualified immunity. This week, they denied them all. So today, we're going to talk about what that means for the fight for police and government accountability and where we can go from here. Patrick, could you start with a refresher on qualified immunity? For those who aren't familiar with the doctrine, what is it, and why is it a problem when it comes to accountability?
Qualified immunity is a judicially created doctrine that the Supreme Court created in 1982, and it acts as a default immunity for all government officials, state, local, and federal, when they violate someone's constitutional rights. And as a matter of practice, what it means is a government official who violates your rights can't be sued unless you can point to another earlier court case from the same federal circuit or the Supreme Court that involved the same particular facts, and the court held that what happened there was a constitutional violation. And so as a result, the most egregious cases of government abuse are granted this special immunity from the Supreme Court. And so, for instance, in just the last year alone, a circuit court granted qualified immunity to police officers who had stolen more than $200,000 because the court said, although stealing is morally wrong in virtually every human society, there's no case in the Ninth Circuit that specifically says police can't steal money from your house. Or another case from the 11th Circuit, where a police officer fired his gun into a group of children trying to kill a non-threatening family dog and instead hitting a 10-year-old. And again, the 11th Circuit said, whether or not that's really bad, it's not clearly unconstitutional because we've never decided a case before where we said recklessly shooting your gun into a group of children is unconstitutional. And so in both of those circuits, the things that the police did are still things police can do in the future with absolute impunity.
And it applies not just to police, is that right? It's all government officials.
Yes. So currently we're talking about police reform a lot. And so when qualified immunity comes up, it's discussed in the context of policing. But actually, qualified immunity applies to all government officials who are enforcing any sort of law. So that includes state, local, and federal. So it goes from local police to IRS agents to mayors to members of the Texas Medical Board.
So it's even more sweeping than people who are concerned about the police right now might even be aware. And, you know, given that and given the implications for it, Bob, what do you make of the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court took the, you know, they considered these cases, they considered them for a long time, holding them over and sort of giving the impression that they were really weighing them, and then deciding to decline all of them? I think there were eight altogether at the end that the court just said, you know, no. What do those of us who think that the accountability is really important and that this is a barrier to it make of that?
Well, the Supreme Court moves in mysterious ways, and it's not unusual for there to be a situation where there's a split of authority in the lower courts and there's a broad cry for the court to take up a case and for the court to just say no, for the court to at least say not yet. And I think the key takeaway is that the court has said no to these cases, but the court can't say no forever. There is an active disagreement in the lower courts about how qualified immunity should work. And there is a genuine outcry from the left, from the right, from sitting federal judges urging the court to do something about qualified immunity. It's not taking these cases, but there will be future cases. And the one thing you can say about qualified immunity is that since the doctrine is kind of set up for outrage, since the doctrine is designed, or at least seems like it was designed, to incentivize the worst behavior and to excuse the most egregious and the most unusual violations of the Constitution, there are going to be more cases. There are going to be more cases that are worth taking that can be brought to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm always struck when I talk about qualified immunity, and I talk about, you know, a lot of outrageous areas of the law in my work. But when I talk about, say, eminent domain abuse, I'll give law students an egregious list of things that have happened in eminent domain abuse. And my list of outrageous cases, I kind of have to go back over the course of the past 5 or 10 years and pick, these are the most outrageous stories I can tell you. When I talk about qualified immunity, I can actually just give you the past year. Just here's the past 12 months in qualified immunity, and it will fill my entire talk. And so these cases are going to keep coming up. And the Supreme Court is eventually going to have to weigh in. The Supreme Court just moves in its own time. The justices like to wait until the moment is completely ripe in their view. And frequently the Supreme Court's vision of when an issue is ripe is very different from the vision of the rest of us. But it's what we've seen, frankly, in all the areas IJ litigates, that it takes not just years, but decades to get an issue squarely in front of the Supreme Court. I think it was more than 10 years from when we launched our national forfeiture initiative to when we won the Timms case, the forfeiture case we won in the U.S. Supreme Court. It takes an awful lot of groundwork, and it takes an awful lot of fighting and scrapping in the lower courts. And I think this felt different because there were so many cases pending and there was such a broad outcry. I mean, you saw editorials and op-eds and publications ranging from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal to USA Today. It seemed like everyone was watching. But sometimes the moment when everyone is watching is the moment when the court doesn't want to step in, perhaps doesn't want to be seen as responding to the broad public outcry, wants to be seen as sort of quietly doing law. But denying cert petitions doesn't make an issue go away. Denying cert petitions can make a case go away, but the issue keeps bubbling up, the issue keeps coming back, and especially with qualified immunity, there are already new cert petitions pending at the Supreme Court, and those are going to continue until the court finally steps in and does something about this egregious mistake that it has made, that it's led the lower courts into.
Well, you mentioned just now, and Patrick mentioned earlier, that this is a court-created doctrine. Does that mean that it is ultimately only the Supreme Court that can get rid of it? Or is this something that, you know, since this is a moment of public outcry, that a legislative, there could be a legislative fix or some other avenue if people keep pushing forward while those cases are bubbling up?
So the Supreme Court created this problem, and it's the Supreme Court's job to fix it. But that doesn't mean it's the Supreme Court is the only entity with the power to fix it. Congress certainly has the power to get rid of qualified immunity, and there's a bill pending right now. It was originally introduced by Representative Amash, but now has sponsorship from Democrats and Republicans and from Representative Amash, who's a member of the Libertarian Party. So it has interest from across the board. Changing legislation is hard, and the difficulty with legislating here is that the court, in adopting qualified immunity, didn't pretend to be interpreting a statute. The court didn't look at the Ku Klux Klan Act, it didn't look at Section 1983 and say, oh, this word means qualified immunity. And so if you want to get rid of qualified immunity, you amend this word. And that's usually what you see when you see a legislative response to what the court does. A statute says it applies to a situation where there are many of something. And the court says, well, many means more than 10. And Congress says, no. What we meant was more than 5. So we're going to amend the statute to make clear that when we say many, we mean more than 5. There's no word they got wrong here. The problem is that they just adopted this policy. And so Congress has the power to fix it, but it's not something that has been squarely in Congress's sights because it's not a misinterpretation of a statute. It's just a wrong-headed judicial policy.
Well, I think another thing, too, that's important to keep in mind when we talk about a potential legislative fix, which, as Bob points out, there are petitions circulating in Congress for legislation that could at least fix in part some of the problems created by qualified immunity. But the thing to highlight is that this is such a legislative heavy lift based on the history, because the original Civil Rights Act that the language we're talking about comes from was something that passed after the 14th Amendment was ratified after the Civil War. And it took President Ulysses S. Grant going around personally advocating for the law to be passed, even in that context, that was aimed at, you know, abuses of state power in the post-war South. And so the point is just, it took an enormous amount of political effort and arguably much more aggressive effort than that, given the Civil War, to get the Civil Rights Act passed in the first place. And then for the Supreme Court to carve this enormous exception to it, and now for people to say, well, let's just have Congress fix it. It's not that simple, and that's actually not how our constitutional system is supposed to work.
And there's also the problem of kind of any atextual judge-made doctrine. You could, in a sense, eliminate the doctrine by just amending section 1983 without adding any words. Just add the word really to the end. And that should get rid of qualified immunity, because there's nothing in section 1983 that tells you to do qualified immunity. There's no hook the court has pointed to in the first place. So you could just adopt the same language again. Like, there's a certain sense in which the legislative work has already been done. The legislative work was done over a century ago. Now we're just talking about what judges are doing with that legislation.
Yeah, and just to really put a pin in it, the thing to keep in mind with the phrasing qualified immunity, it sounds somewhat benign, but really what it means is constitutional exceptions. That's what qualified immunity is. It's the Supreme Court saying the Constitution doesn't apply to any government official unless the victim can satisfy these difficult to satisfy standards of pointing to an earlier case. So at its most basic level, what qualified immunity does is hand out exceptions to the Constitution to the very people who take an oath to uphold the Constitution.
We've talked a lot about the public outcry and sort of the feeling that this is a real moment with reckoning for with qualified immunity. But there have also been some voices in the media, especially, you know, recently the Wall Street Journal ran a piece that indicated that maybe it won't actually make that big a difference if we reform qualified immunity. You know, it actually only comes up just fairly infrequently, and when it does. What is your response to that, Patrick? Is it actually going to be that effective in allowing people to vindicate their rights if we do get rid of this doctrine?
Yes, it is definitely going to be effective. And I'll also point out that until very recently, there have effectively been no defenders of qualified immunity from a doctrinal perspective. There have not been academics or public interest organizations or politicians who have spent much time defending qualified immunity, because it is just a judicially created doctrine that the Supreme Court made for policy reasons. But now that it's kind of becoming at least a very talked about subject, if not a political one, as discussions of police reform start to take center stage in national politics, you're starting to see some people come out with justifications for qualified immunity. And two of the leading arguments are, first, that it won't really help the victims of constitutional violations very much. And the second is that it will really hurt police. And so the first one, that it's sort of an ineffective way to help victims of constitutional violations, is based on the misreading of important academic work done by Joanna Schwartz that shows that the number you'll see a lot is that fewer than 4% of cases are completely dismissed for qualified immunity, meaning, at least as being used in these op-eds, that qualified immunity is really not that big of an obstacle for people. But that's not actually what the studies show. The studies show that there are a bunch of other barriers to bringing civil rights lawsuits that apply generally to any lawsuit. And so you can't bring a frivolous lawsuit regardless of whether it's a constitutional lawsuit or whether it's a contract dispute or a tort dispute under state law. And the point of the study is that when qualified immunity applies, it applies to the really serious and important constitutional violations. That's when it steps in and slams the courthouse door shut on the victims of those violations and basically says, it doesn't matter what happened to you, you can't litigate against these particular defendants. So that's the first argument. The second argument is that it'll be really bad for cops. If we get rid of qualified immunity, we won't be able to hire police. They won't be able to do their job. Well, the problem with that is that until 1967, there was no sort of defense at all. And so police from the early 1800s, when police forces started being formed in the United States, through 1967, were able to balance their duty to protect and serve with their duties to refrain from unreasonable searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment of the Bill of Rights. And that's the thing that I think conservatives should really consider, which is that we already have special protections for police to make decisions in split-second life and death circumstances. And that's the language of the Fourth Amendment itself, which only prohibits government officials from undertaking unreasonable searches and seizures. And so if an officer is reasonable, which is always considered based on all of the circumstances in which they act, they haven't violated the Constitution at all, and they don't need any sort of special protection. So the Constitution says police don't have to act perfectly. They just have to act reasonably. Qualified immunity just is thrown into the mix and totally throws off all the incentives. It does make it harder for people whose constitutional rights have been violated to vindicate those rights. And it doesn't actually make it any easier for police to do their job as constitutionally intended.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing really, getting rid of qualified immunity doesn't mean that citizens will always win. It doesn't mean the government will always lose. What getting rid of qualified immunity would mean is that outcomes of constitutional cases would be less arbitrary. The government would win when the government didn't violate the Constitution. That citizens would win when the government did violate the Constitution. And instead, under qualified immunity, the outcomes seem almost utterly random because it hinges not on what the government did to you or what the constitutional doctrine is. It hinges just on what cases a court happens to have already decided. So you can take exactly the same behavior. Let's say that government officials have done something that we can all agree is unreasonable. They destroyed your house with grenades. And the outcome of the case hinges entirely on whether, let's say there is a court case that decides that it's unreasonable to destroy your house with grenades. And if that court case came out 6 months before the government destroyed your house, you win. If that court case came out 6 months after the government destroyed your house, you lose. And even though we all understand that the government officials who used the grenades had never read that case, they don't read those cases, they don't keep track of them, that's an utterly ridiculous basis on which to hinge official liability for violating the Constitution. I can't even come up with an explanation that says that's the right criterion on which to base liability, on which to base an award. We should be basing these cases on the Constitution. We should be basing these cases on the facts of what happened. And instead, we base them on this fiction that says, oh, everyone involved scrupulously reads published federal court opinions, memorizes all the details, and structures their behavior accordingly, when that's a thing that literally no one believes is true.
Right. And so just to sum that up, what Bob's saying is without qualified immunity, these cases would be decided based on whether the government officials violated the Constitution. But since we have qualified immunity, often courts don't even get to that part of the analysis. So to go back to the cases I highlighted earlier where the police are alleged to have stolen $200,000 and the officer fired into the group of children to kill a dog but actually hit a kid instead, both of those cases granted qualified immunity to the officers but never addressed whether what they did was or was not constitutional and actively said that they were not going to decide that question. And so it just kind of shows you how divorced from the Constitution qualified immunity makes our courts decide these cases.
And doesn't that become sort of a hopeless endeavor then for the individuals bringing the cases if the courts are only ever deciding the qualified immunity question and never getting to the constitutional question? How do you ever have the grenades case that you can point to?
Exactly. It's definitely a catch-22 where if you have to point to a case and courts don't decide any more cases, you can't win going forward. So in California, police can still steal money as part of executing a search warrant, and they'll be granted qualified immunity because there's a case that specifically says this isn't clearly established, in the same way that a cop can shoot into a group of kids in the 11th Circuit, and the same outcome will be the result. But it's to the point of absolute absurdity, but you put your finger on it, which is that how does constitutional law develop when courts don't have to even address the constitutional questions? And what are people supposed to do to vindicate their constitutional rights if courts are no longer granting and deciding these constitutional issues, but you're required to point to those cases if you want a chance to get into the courthouse?
So as constitutional litigators, we talked a little bit about the prospects or maybe even the lack thereof for legislative change. The fact that these cases are going to keep coming. How do you proceed in fighting out an issue like that when it is, you know, when you're in the lower courts, when you have to start kind of over again?
I mean, you proceed by finding the pressure points. You proceed just as you do with any other issue that we litigate at the Institute for Justice, which is you push on these disagreements that exist in the lower courts, and you find cases, and you bring cases, and you take over cases that present exactly the facts you need. You know, the focus for the past several months has been on the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court had this big pile of petitions, and it relisted them several times. And now that they've denied denied those over a very persuasive dissent by Justice Thomas. You take that dissent and you go back to the lower courts and you continue fighting until you break through. A lot of public interest litigation is about just sort of carefully sharpening the edges and carefully grinding until you get the exact instrument that you need to take to the U.S. Supreme Court. Kind of put differently, as I said to one of my colleagues yesterday, a lot of this job is just taking it in the teeth, for years on end until eventually it stops. And that's one thing that, frankly, I think we at IJ have perfected, that we are accustomed to setbacks. We're accustomed to the fact that these projects take years. I have never in my career been involved in a six-month campaign to do anything here. Everything takes years. These are difficult issues, and there are decades of ingrained precedents and ingrained attitudes that we are pushing back against. And the only thing you can do is keep pushing, keep establishing either a better version of the rule or a more outrageous version of the rule. Either we make the law better or we keep bringing cases that lay out and demonstrate exactly how outrageous the current state of the law is, which means kind of either way, we're moving the needle. And it's just a matter of the next batch of cases and the next people up.
Well, thank you both for joining me today. And thank you for watching. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe. Thank you.